Chapter 3. Sumna. If the world is a game whose rules are written by the god, and sorcerers are those who cheat and cheat, then who has written the rules of sorcery? Zarathinius, a defense of the arcane arts. Early spring, 4110, year of the Tusk, en route to Sumna. On the Sea of Menenor, a storm touched them. Akamian awoke from another of the dreams, hugging himself. The ancient wars of his sleep seemed tangled with the blackness of his cabin, the pitching floor, and the chorus of thundering water. He lay huddled, shivering as he fumbled to sort out the real from the dream. Faces haunted the blackness, cramped in astonishment and horror. Bronze-armored forms struggled across the distance. Smoke smeared the horizon, and rising, knotted like branches of black iron, was a dragon, Skafra. A thunderclap. On the deck, braced against the sheets of rain, the Nroni sailors wailed, supplicating themselves to Momas, aspect of storm and sea, and god of dice. The Nroni merchantmen weighed anchor outside the harbor of Sumna, the ancient center of the Enrithi faith. Leaning against a weathered rail, Akamian watched the pilot's boat row toward them through the swells. The great city was indistinct in the background, but he could discern the structures of the Hagurna, the vast compound of temples, granaries, and barracks that form the administrative heart of the thousand temples. In its center rose the legendary bastions of the Junrayuma, the holy sanctum of the Tusk. He could feel the tug of what should have been their grandeur, but they seemed mute in the distance, dumb, just more stone. For the Enrithi, this was the place where the heavens inhabited the earth. Sumna, the Hagurna, and the Junrayuma were far more than geographical sites. They were bound up in the very purpose of history. They were the hinges of destiny. But they were eggshells of stone to Akamian. The Hagurna called to men unlike himself, men who could not, he supposed, escape the weight of their time, men like his former student, Inrau. Whenever Inrau had discussed the Hagurna, he would speak as though the god himself had laid the keel of his words. Akamian had felt more than faintly alienated by this talk, as so often happened when confronted by another's excessive enthusiasm. There would be a momentum to Inrau's tone, a mad certainty that could put cities, even nations, to the sword, as though his righteous joy could be attached to any act of madness. Here again was reason why Mathanet should be so deeply feared. To possess this momentum was disease enough, but to be a carrier. There was pause for thought. Mathanet carried a plague whose primary symptom was certainty. How the god could be equated with the absence of hesitation was something Akamian had never understood. After all, what was the god but the mystery that burdened them all? What was hesitation but a dwelling within this mystery? "Perhaps then I am among the most pious of men," he thought, smiling inwardly. He was a man who lavished himself with false flattery, too much brooding. "Mathanet," he muttered under his breath, but the name was also empty. It could neither tether the grandiose rumors that fluttered about it, nor provide motive enough for the crimes he was about to commit. As though drawn by some half-understood sense of obligation to his sole passenger, the captain of the merchantman joined his meditative silence, standing somewhat nearer than prescribed by the dictates of Jinan, a common low-caste error. He was a sturdy man, constructed, it seemed, of the same wood as his ship. Salt and sun on his forearms, the sea in his unkempt hair and beard. "This city," he finally said, "is not such a good place for someone like you." Someone like me, a sorcerer in a holy city. There was no indictment in the man's words or his tone. The Nroni had grown used to the mandate, to mandate gifts and mandate demands, but they were still Enrithi, the faithful. A certain blankness of expression was their solution to this contradiction. They always spoke around the fact of their heresy, perhaps hoping that if they didn't touch it with words, they might somehow carry away their faith intact. They never know what we are, Akamian said. That's the horrible fact of sinners. We're indistinguishable from the righteous.
So I've been told, the man replied, avoiding his eyes. The few can see only each other.
There was something disturbing about his tone, as though he probed for the details of some illicit sexual act. Why speak of this? Was the fool trying to ingratiate himself? An image struck Akamian, himself as a boy, climbing on the big rocks, the ones his father had used to dry the nets, pausing every few breathless instants simply to look around him. Something had happened. It was as though he'd opened different eyelids, ones beneath those he normally opened each morning. Everything was so agonizingly tight, as though the flesh of the world had been dried taut across the gaps between bone, the net against stone, the grid of shadows cast over the hollows, the watery beads cupped between the flecks of tendons on his hands, so clear. And within this tightness, the sensation of inner blooming, of the collapse of seeing into being, as though his eyes had been wrung into the very heart of things. From the surface of the stone, he could see himself, a dark child towering across the disk of the sun. The very fabric of existence, the Anta. He had, and he could still never adequately express this, experienced it. Unlike most others, he'd known immediately. He was one of the few, known with a child's stubborn certainty. At Yersis, he could remember crying, feeling the vertigo of a life no longer to be determined by his caste, by his father, or by the past. Those times when the mandate had passed through his fishing village had profoundly marked him as a boy. First, the clash of symbols, and then the cloaked figures, shielded by parasols and borne by slaves, steeped in the erotic aura of mystery. So remote. Faces impassive, touched only by the finest cosmetics, and by the proper Janic contempt for low-caste fishermen and their sons. Only men of mythic stature could reside behind such faces. This he knew. Men braced by the glory of the sagas, dragon slayers and assassins of kings, prophets and abominations. Mere months of training at Yersis had seen that childishness wane. Jaded, pompous, and self-deceived, at Yersis differed only in scale. Am I so different from this man? Akamian asked himself, watching the captain in his periphery. Not really, he thought. But he ignored the man nonetheless and turned back to stare at Sumna, hazy against the dark hills. And yet he was different. So many cares, and the wages so slight. Different in that his tantrums could sweep away city gates, pulverize flesh and snap bone. Such power, and yet the same vanities, the same fears, and far darker whims. He had expected the mythic to raise him up, to exalt his every act, and instead he was set adrift. Detachment enlightened no one. He could turn the ship into a shining inferno, then walk unscathed across the surface of the water, and yet he could never be certain. He had almost whispered this aloud. The captain left momentarily, visibly relieved to be called away by his crew. The pilot had drawn up to the rolling ship. Why are they so distant to me? Stung by this thought, he lowered his head, stared into the wine-dark depths. Whom do I despise? To ask this question was to answer it. How could one not feel isolated, detached, when existence itself answered to their tongue? Where was the hard ground on which one might stand when mere words could sweep everything away? It had become a truism among scholars in the Three Seas to compare sorcerers to poets, a comparison Akamian had always thought absurd. He could scarcely imagine two vocations so tragically at odds. Save fear or political machination, no sorcerer had ever created with his words. The power, the brilliant flurries of light, possessed an irresistible direction, and it was the wrong one, the direction of destruction. It was as though men could only ape the language of God, could only debase and brutalize his song,
When sorcerers sing, the saying went, men die. When sorcerers sing. And yet even among his own he was anathema. The other schools could never forgive the mandate their heritage, their possession of the Gnosis, the knowledge of the ancient North. Before their extinction, the great schools of the North had possessed benefactors, pilots to navigate them through shoals no human mind could conceive of. The Gnosis of the Nanmen Magi, the Kuya, refined through another 1,000 years of human cunning. In so many ways he was a god to these fools. He needed always to remember this, not merely because it was flattering, but because it was they who could not forget. They who feared, and thus they who inevitably hated. So much that they would risk all in a holy war against the schools. A sorcerer who forgot this hatred forgot how to stay alive. Standing before the blurred immensity of Sumna, Akamian listened to the seamen bicker in the background, and to the ship groan in rhythm with the swells. He thought of the burning of the white ships of Neliost 1,000 years ago. He could still taste the musty smoke, see the glitter of doom across the evening waters, feel his other body shivering in the cold. And Akamian wondered where it all went, the past, and why, if it were gone, it made his heart ache so. In the choked streets beyond the quays, Akamian, who often became contemplative in the press of men, was once again struck by the absurdity of his presence here. It was a minor miracle that the 1,000 temples had ever allowed the schools to maintain missions in Sumna. For the Inrithi, there was a sense that Sumna was not merely the heart of their faith and their priesthood, but the very heart of God, literally. The Chronicle of the Tusk was the most ancient and therefore the most thunderous voice of the past, so ancient that it was itself without any clear history. Innocent, as the great Cnaean commentator Gaiterius had written. Ribboned by characters, the Tusk recorded the great migratory invasions that marked the ascendancy of man in the Iarwa. For whatever reason, the Tusk had always been in the possession of one tribe, the Ketye. And since the earliest days of Shigek, before even the rise of Kyrenius, it had been installed in Sumna, or so the surviving record suggested. As a result, Sumna and the Tusk had become inseparable in the thoughts of men. Pilgrimages to Sumna and to the Tusk were one and the same, as though the place had become an artifact, and the artifact a place. To walk in Sumna was to walk through scripture. Small wonder he felt out of place. He found himself being jostled behind a small train of mules. Arms and shoulders, scowling faces and shouts, movement through the small street came to a halt. Never had he seen the city so maddeningly crowded. He turned to one of the men pressing him, a Conryan by appearance, solemn, broad-shouldered, with a heavy beard, a member of the warrior caste. "Tell me," Akamian asked in Shaiak. "What's happening here?" He dispensed with Jinan in his impatience. They were, after all, sharing sweat. The man appraised him with dark eyes, a curious look on his face. "You mean you don't know?" he asked, raising his voice above the din. "Know what?" Akamian replied, feeling a small tickle in his spine. "Mathanet has called the faithful to Sumna," he said, suspicious of Akamian's ignorance. "He's to reveal the object of the holy war." Akamian was stunned. He glanced at the faces packed around them, abruptly realizing how many of them had the hard-bitten look of war. Nearly all of them were openly armed. The first half of his mission, to discover the object of Mathanet's holy war, was about to be accomplished for him. Notsera and the others must have known. But why didn't they tell me? Because they needed him to come to Sumna. They knew he would resist recruiting Inrao, so they'd assembled everything they could to convince him that he must. A lie of omission, perhaps not so great a sin, but it had rendered him pliant to their purposes nonetheless. Manipulation upon manipulation. Even the quorum played games with their own pieces. It was an old outrage, but it never failed to sting. The man had continued speaking, his eyes bright with sudden fervor. "Pray that it's the schools we war against, my friend, rather than the Fainim. Sorcery is ever the greater cancer. Akamian almost agreed. Akamian reached out, planning to draw a finger through the groove down the center of Esmanet's back, but he hesitated, clasping a handful of stained coverings instead. The room was dark, thick with the heat of their coupling. Through the shadows, he could see the scatter of crumbs and refuse across the floor. A blinding white crack in the shutters was the only source of light. The thunder of the street beyond had the rattle of thin walls. Nothing else? He said, feeling remotely shocked by the unsteadiness in his own voice. What do you mean, nothing else? Her voice was marked by an old and patient bruise. She had misunderstood, but before he could explain, a sudden sense of nausea and suffocating heat struck him. He pushed himself from the bed to his feet and immediately felt as though he might fall to his knees. His legs buckled, and he drunkenly braced himself against the sideboards. Chills skittered through his arm hairs and across his scalp and back.
Akka? She asked.
Fine, he replied. The heat. He drew himself up and rolled back onto the wheeling mattress. Her body felt like burning eels against his own. Such heat, so early in spring. It was as though the very world had grown feverish at the prospect of Mathanet's holy war.
You've suffered the fevers before, she said,
her voice apprehensive. The fevers were not contagious. Everyone knew this. Yes, he said thickly, holding his forehead.
You're safe.
They possessed me 6 years ago while on mission in Kingulat. I almost died.
6 years ago? She repeated. My daughter died the same year.
Bitterness. He found himself resenting the ease with which his pain had become hers. An image of what her daughter might look like came to him. Sturdy but fine-boned, dark, languid hair chopped low-caste short, a cheek perfectly curved to the cup of a palm. But it was Esme he actually envisaged, her as a child. They were silent a long time. His thoughts settled. The heat became embalming, lost the acrid edge of their exertions. She had mistaken what he'd said earlier, he realized, remembering the strange bruise in her tone. He had merely wanted to know if there was anything more to the rumors. In a way, he'd always known he would return here, not only to Sumna, but to this place between the arms and legs of this tired woman, Esmanet. A strange, old-fashioned name for a woman of her character, but at the same time oddly appropriate for a prostitute. Esmanet. How could a name affect him so? She had dwindled in the 4 years since he had last come to Sumna. More haggard, her humor gouged by the accumulation of small wounds. Without hesitation, he'd searched for her after struggling through the packed harbor, struck by his own eagerness. Seeing her sitting in her window had been strange, an intermingling of loss and vanity, as though he'd recognized a childhood rival behind the bitten face of a leper or a beggar.
Still fetching sticks, I see,
she'd said, her eyes remarkably untouched by surprise. The child fat had also disappeared from her wit. Gradually, she'd gathered him from his worries into her intricate world of anecdote and satire. Inexorably, the moments had led to this room, and Akamian had made love to her with an urgency that shocked him, as though he'd found an impossible reprieve in the animality of the act, a reprieve from the turmoil of his mission. Akamian had come to Sumna for two reasons: to determine whether this new Shrya planned to wage his holy war against the schools, and to learn whether the consult had any hand in these remarkable events. The first had been a tangible goal, something he could use to rationalize his betrayal of Inrao. The second, ghostly, possessing the feverish anemia of excuses that fall far short of absolution. How could he use the Mandate's war against the consult to rationalize betrayal, when the war itself had come to seem so irrational? How else could one describe a war without a foe? Tomorrow I must find Inrao, he said, more to the darkness than to Esmanet.
Do you still intend to turn him?
I don't know. I know precious little anymore.
How can you say that, Akka? I sometimes wonder if there's anything you don't know. She had always been the consummate whore, nursing first his loins and then his heart. I don't know if I could bear this again. I've spent my entire life among people who think me mad, Esme. She laughed at this. Though born a caste menial and never educated, formally anyway, Esmanette had always possessed a keen appreciation of irony. It was one of the many things that so distinguished her from the other women, the other prostitutes. I've spent my entire life among people who think me a harlot, Akka. Akamian smiled in the darkness. But it's not the same. You are a harlot.
So you're not mad, then?
She giggled at this, and Akamian felt himself sour. This girlishness was a charade, or so he'd always thought, something concocted for her men. It reminded him that he was a customer, that they weren't lovers after all. But that's just it, Esme. Whether I'm mad or no depends on whether my enemy exists. He hesitated, as though these words had delivered him to a breathless precipice.
Esmanette, you believe me, don't you?
Believe an inveterate liar like you? Please don't insult me. Flare of irritation, immediately regretted.
No, seriously.
She paused before answering.
Do I believe the consult exists?
She doesn't. People who repeated questions Akamian knew feared answering them. Her beautiful brown eyes studied him in the gloom.
Let's just say, Akka, that I believe the question of the consult exists.
There was something beseeching in her look. He felt more chills.
Isn't that enough?
She asked. Even for him, the consult had withdrawn from the terror of fact to the rootless anxiety of questions. Had he, by mourning the absence of an answer, forgotten the importance of the question? I must find Inrau tomorrow, he said. Her fingers burrowed through his beard across his chin. He raised his head like a cat.
We make a sad couple,
she said, as though making a casual observation. Why would you say that?
A sorcerer and a harlot. There's something sad about that.
He grasped her hand and kissed the tips of her fingers. There's something sad about all couples, he said. In his dream, Inrau walked through canyons of burnt brick, through faces and figures illuminated by rags of torchlight, and he heard a voice from nowhere, crying through his bones, across every finger's breadth of his skin, speaking words like the shadows of fists striking just beyond the corner of his eyes. Words that battered whatever will remained to him. Words that walked with his limbs. He glimpsed the sagging facade of a tavern, then a low golden dim enclosure of smoke, tables, and overhead beams. The entrance enveloped him. The rising ground tipped forward, directed him toward a malevolent blackness in the far corner of the room. It too enveloped him. Another entrance. Everything rushed into the bearded man, his head slack against the chapped stucco, his face on a lazy upward angle, but tight with some forbidden ecstasy, light spilling from his working mouth, flakes of sun in his eyes.
Akamian.
Then the impossible mutter trailed into the rumble of patrons. The murky interior of the tavern became sturdy and mundane, the nightmarish angles squared. The play of light and shadow became crisp.
What are you doing here?
Inrau sputtered, struggling to clear his thoughts.
Do you realize what's happening?
He scanned the interior of the tavern and through beams and haze saw a table of shrial knights in a far corner. So far they hadn't noticed him. Akamian watched him sourly.
It's good to see you too, boy.
Inrau scowled.
Don't call me boy.
Akamian grinned.
But what else, he winked, is a beloved uncle supposed to call his nephew, boy?
Inrau exhaled a long breath and leaned back into his chair.
It is good to see you, Uncle Akka.
No lie there. Despite the hurtful circumstances, it was good to see him. For some time he'd regretted leaving his old teacher's side. Sumna and the Thousand Temples were not the places, the sanctuaries, he'd imagined them to be, at least not until Mathanet had been elected to the seat.
I have missed you, Inrau continued. But Sumna
is not such a good place for someone like me, I know.
Then why have you come? Surely you've heard the rumors.
I didn't simply come, Inrao. Akamian paused, his face abruptly troubled. I was sent. Inrao's scalp prickled.
Oh, no, Akamian. Please, tell me.
We need to know about this Mathanet, Akamian said in a forced tone. About his holy war. Surely you can see this. Akamian downed his bowl of wine. For an instant, he looked broken. But the sudden pity Inrao felt for the man who in so many ways had become his father, was dwarfed by a giddy sense of groundlessness.
But you promised, Akka. You promised.
Tears glittered in the schoolman's eyes. Wise tears, but filled with regret nonetheless. The world has had the habit, Akamian said, of breaking the back of my promises. Though Akamian had hoped to present Inrao the front of a teacher at last acknowledging a former student as his peer, an unvoiced question continued to rattle him. What am I doing? Studying the young man, he felt a pang of affection. His face looked strangely aquiline, shaven as it was in the Nansur fashion. But the voice was familiar, the way it grew more and more tangled in competing ideas, and his eyes as well, exuberant, wide, and glassy brown, perpetually hinged on the cusp of honest self-doubt. Inrao had been cursed more than others, Akamian reflected, to be given the gift of the few. In temperament, he was ideally suited to be a priest of the Thousand Temples. The touch of selfless candor, of forward passion, these were things the mandate would have stripped from him.
But Mathanet is more than you can understand, Inrao was saying.
The young man's entire body seemed to flinch from the round, rushing air of the tavern.
Some almost worship him, though this angers him. He's to be obeyed, not worshipped. That's why he took his name.
His name? It hadn't occurred to Akamian that his name might mean something. This, in itself, disturbed him. It was a shrial tradition to take a new name. How could such simple things slip past him?
Yes, Inrao replied, from Me Tethana.
Akamian was unfamiliar with the word, but before he could ask, Inrao continued his explanation, his tone defiant, as though the former student could only now, finally beyond the reach of the mandate, vent old resentments. Its meaning would be unknown to you. Me Tethana is Thoti Eonorian, the language of the Tusk. It means instruction.
So, what's the lesson?
And none of it troubles you? Akamian asked.
None of what troubles me?
The fact that Mathanet so effortlessly secured the seat? That he was able in a matter of weeks to purge the shrial apparati of all the Emperor's spies?
Trouble me!
Inrao cried incredulously.
My heart exults at these things. You have no inkling how deeply I despaired when I first came to Sumna, when I first realized how sordid and corrupt the Thousand Temples had become, realized that the Shrya himself was simply another of the Emperor's dogs. And then Mathanet arrived, like a storm, one of those rare summer storms that sweep the earth clean.
Troubled by the ease with which he cleansed Sumna? Akka, I rejoiced.
Then what of this holy war? Does your heart also rejoice at the thought of this, the thought of another scholastic war?
Inrao hesitated, as though shocked his earlier momentum had so quickly stalled.
No one knows the object of his holy war,
he said numbly. As much as Inrao despised the mandate, Akamian knew the thought of its destruction horrified him.
Part of him dwells with us still.
And if Mathanet does declare against the schools, what will you think of him then?
He won't, Akka. I'm certain of this.
But that wasn't my question, was it? Akamian inwardly winced at the ruthlessness of his tone. If Mathanet declares against the schools, what then? Inrao drew his hands, delicate hands for a man, Akamian had always thought, across his face.
I don't know, Akka. I've asked this same question 1,000 times, and still I don't know.
But why is that? You're a shrial priest now, Inrao, an apostle of the god as revealed by the latter prophet in the Tusk. Doesn't the Tusk demand that all sorcerers be burned?
Yes, but...
But the mandate is different. An exception?
Yes, it is different.
Why? Because an old fool whom you once loved is one of them?
Keep your voice down,
Inrao hissed, glancing apprehensively at the table of Shrial Knights.
You know full well why, Akka. Because I love you as a father and a friend, certainly, but because I also respect the Mandate mission.
So if Mathanet declares against the schools, what would you think?
I would grieve.
Grieve? I don't think so, Inrao. You'd think he's mistaken. As brilliant and as holy as Mathanet may be, you'd think he hasn't seen what I've seen. Inrao nodded vacantly.
The Thousand Temples, Akamian continued, his tone more gentle, has always been the most powerful of the great factions, but that power has often been blunted, if not broken, by corruption. Mathanet is the first Shrya in centuries to reclaim its preeminence, and now in the secret councils of every faction, ruthless men ask, what will Mathanet do with this power?
Who will he instruct with his holy war? The Fainim and their Kishorim priests? Or will he instruct those condemned by the Tusk, the schools? Never has Sumna been filled with as many spies as now. They circle the holy precincts like vultures about the promise of a corpse. House Ikuri and the Scarlet Spires will try to devise ways to yoke Mathanet's agenda to their own. The Kianin and the Kisharim will keep a wary eye on his every move, fearing that his lesson is for them. Minimize or exploit Inrao. All of them are here for one of these two reasons. Only the Mandate stands outside this sordid circle. An old tactic, made effective by desperate wit. When recruiting a spy, one had to open a safe place with words, make it appear that what was at stake wasn't betrayal, but a further, more demanding fidelity. Frames. Give them greater frames with which to interpret the treachery out of their actions. Before all, a spy who recruits spies must be a master storyteller.
I know this, Inrao said, staring at the palm of his right hand. I do know this.
And if there's anywhere, Akamian said, that a hidden faction might be found, it's here. All the reasons you've given me for your devotion to Mathanet are reasons why the Mandate must have eyes in the Thousand Temples. If the consult is to be found anywhere, Inrao, it will be found here. In a sense, all Akamian had done was issue a string of non-contentious declarations, but the story he'd conjured for Inrao was clear, even if the young man could not recognize it as such. Of all the Shrial priests in the Hagurna, Inrao alone would be the one who saw the greater frame, the one who acted on interests that were not provincial or self-deceived. The Thousand Temples was a good place, but it was hapless. It had to be protected from its own innocence.
But the consult, Inrao said, fixing Akamian with a pained look. What if they have died out? If I do what you ask for nothing, Akka, then I'll be damned.
As though fearing instant retribution, he anxiously peeked over his shoulder.
But the question, Inrao, is what if they...
Akamian paused, stilled by the young priest's horrified expression.
What is it? They've seen me.
Rigid swallow.
The Shrial Knights behind me, to your left.
Akamian had noticed the Knights enter shortly after his arrival, but aside from ensuring they weren't among the few, he'd paid them scant attention. And why should he? With missions such as this, being conspicuous was typically an asset. Skulkers drew attention, not braggarts. He hazarded a glance at the small grotto of lamplight where the three Knights sat. The one, a stocky man with woolly hair, still wore his hauberk, but the other two were attired in the gold-trimmed white of the Thousand Temples, the same as Inrao, though their dress consisted of the queer blend of martial uniform and priestly vestment unique to the Shrial Knights. The armored man sketched loops in the air with a chicken bone, avidly describing something, a woman or a battle perhaps, to his comrade across the table. The man between them, his face slack with upper-caste arrogance, met Akamian's eyes and nodded. Without a word to his companions, the knight stood and began striding toward their table. One of them comes, Akamian said, pouring himself another bowl of wine. Be afraid, calm, whatever, but let me talk, understood? A breathless nod.
The Shrial Knight negotiated the intervening tables and patrons in a brusque manner, pausing once to firmly press a stumbling teamster from his path. He was lean and patrician tall, clean-shaven, with short jet-black hair. The white of his elaborate tunic seemed to shrug off every shadow, but for some reason his face did not. He arrived bearing the scent of jasmine and myrrh. Inrau looked up.
"I thought I recognized you,"
the Shrial Knight said.
"Inrau, isn't it?"
Yes, Lord Sarcellus.
Lord Sarcellus?
The name was unfamiliar to a Kamian, but Inrau's shock could only mean he was someone powerful, too powerful to ordinarily trouble himself with petty temple functionaries. A knight commander. A Kamian glanced past his torso and saw the other two knights watching. The armored one leaned sideways and muttered something that made the other laugh. This is some kind of lark, something to amuse his friends.
"And who's this now?" Sarcellus asked, turning to Akamian. "Is he giving you any trouble?"
Akamian quaffed his wine and glared at a furious angle away from the knight commander, a drunken elder who did not brook interruptions.
"The boy is my sister's son," he grated, "and he's neck deep in shit."
Then, as though an afterthought, he added,
"Lord."
"Is he now?"
"For what, pray tell?"
Groping through his pockets, as though he looked for a misplaced coin, Akamian shook his head in mock disgust, still refusing to lay eyes on his inquisitor.
"For acting a fool, what else? He may wear the gold and white, but he's a priggish idiot all the same. And who are you to upbraid a Shrial priest, hmm?" "What, me chastise Inrau?"
Akamian exclaimed, affecting a drunk, sarcastic fright.
"As far as I'm concerned, the boy's a plum. I only bear my sister's message."
"Ah, I see. And who would she be, then?"
Akamian shrugged and grinned, momentarily regretting his full mouth of teeth.
"My sister? My sister is a rutting sow."
Sarcellus blinked.
"Hmm. And what does that make you?"
"A sow's brother," Akamian cried, at last looking the man full in the face. "Small wonder the boy's in shit, eh?"
Sarcellus smiled, but his large brown eyes remained curiously dead. He turned back to Inrau.
"The Shrier demands our industry, young apostle, more so now than any time previous. Soon he will declare the object of our holy war. Are you sure that carousing with buffoons, even those bound to you by blood, is wise on the eve of something so momentous?"
"And what about you?"
Akamian muttered, reaching for more wine.
"Heed your uncle, boy. Puffed up pompous curs like—"
Sarcellus's backhand snapped his head sideways, threw his chair on two teetering legs, then sent him crashing to the cobbled floor. The tavern erupted in shouts and howls. Sarcellus kicked the chair aside and, with the routine air of a tracker examining a trail, crouched over him. Akamian shielded his face behind convulsive arms. Somehow the mummer within him managed to squall,
"Murder!"
An iron hand clamped about the nape of his neck and yanked him forward, lifting his ear to Sarcellus's lips.
"How I've longed to do that, pig,"
the man whispered. Then he was gone. The bruising floor, a glimpse of his retreating back. Akamian tried to push himself up. Fucking legs. Where were they? Head lolling back, a white teardrop of lantern light shining across hanging brass, illuminating beams and ceiling, cobwebs and mummified flies. Then Inrau, behind him, grunting as he pulled him to his feet, whispering something inaudible as he steered him to his seat. Propped in his chair, he waved away Inrau's mothering hands.
"I'm fine," he croaked. "Just need a moment. Catch my breath."
Akamian sucked air through his nostrils, pressed a hand against the side of his face, and drew hooked fingers through his beard. Inrau resumed his seat and apprehensively watched him reach for the wine.
A bit more dramatic than I intended,
Akamian said in an airy semblance of good humor.
When his faltering hand spilled the first of the wine, Inrao reached out and gently tugged the decanter from him.
Akka, fucking hands, always shaking.
Akamian watched him pour a bowl.
Calm. How could the boy be so calm?
A bit too dramatic, but effective. Effective all the same. And that's all that matters.
With thumb and forefinger, he wiped the tears from his eyes. Where did they come from?
The sting. That's it. The sting.
I worked his levers, boy.
A snort that was intended as a laugh.
Did you see how I did that?
I saw.
Good, he declared, gulping down his bowl and gasping.
Watch and learn. Watch and learn.
Inral silently poured him another. Akamian's cheek and jaw, once fiery and numb, began to ache. An unaccountable rage seized him.
The furies I could have unleashed,
he spat, low enough to ensure he couldn't be overheard.
What if he comes back?
He glanced hurriedly over at Sarcellus and the other two Shrial knights. They were laughing about something, some joke or something, something.
The words I know, he snarled. I could have boiled his heart and his chest.
Another bowl quaffed, like burning oil in his frigid gut.
I've done it before.
Was that me?
Akka,
Inrao said. I'm afraid.
Never had Akamian seen so many gathered in one place, not even in Seswatha's dreams. The great central square of the Hagurno was a wilderness of humanity. In the distance, bathed in sunlight, the sloped walls of the Junraiuma towered over the masses. Of the surrounding structures, it alone seemed immune to the multitudes. The other buildings, engineered in the later and more graceful days of the Canaan Empire, were overwhelmed by squirming thickets of warriors, wives, slaves, and tradesmen. Hanging arms and indistinct faces congested the balconies and long colonnades of the administrative compounds. Scores of youths were perched like pigeons across the curved horns and haunches of the three Agoglian bulls that ordinarily dominated the heart of the plaza. Even the broad processional avenues, which wound down into the haze of Greater Sumna, were thick and sluggish with people, latecomers who still hoped to press closer, closer to Mathanet and his revelation. It hadn't taken Akamian long to regret pressing so close to the Junraiuma. Sweat stung his eyes. From all sides, limbs and bodies lurched against him. At long last, Mathanet was to announce the object of his holy war. And like water to a basin, the faithful had come in floods. Akamian found himself periodically clamped by tides of movement. Standing still was impossible. The pressure behind him would swell, and he would find himself thrown against the backs of those before him. He could almost believe nothing moved at all save the ground at their feet, yanked by some hidden army of priests eager to see them suffocate. At some point he cursed everything. The punishing sun, the thousand temples, the forearm between his shoulders, Mathanet. But his most savage moments he reserved for Nocera and for his own damned curiosity. It seemed a combination of these two had placed him in this position. Then he realized, if Mathanet declares against the schools. Among so many, what were the chances that he would be recognized as a sorcerer, as a spy? Already he'd encountered several men bearing the giddy aura of a trinket. It was customary for members of the ruling castes to wear their kore openly about their necks. The mobs were pocked by tiny points that whispered death. Me, the first casualty of the new scholastic wars. The irony of this thought was enough to make him grimace. Images flitted before his soul's eye, of fanatics pointing at him and shrieking, "Blasphemer! Blasphemer!" of his broken body tossed atop furious mobs.
How could I be such a fool?
Fear, heat, and stench buffeted him with nausea. His cheek and jaw throbbed anew. He'd seen others, their temples latticed by shining veins, their eyes drowsy with a confusion of near unconsciousness, lifted from the crowd and passed beneath the sun along a wave of uplifted hands. Watching them had stilled Akamian with both wonder and dismay, though he knew not why. He looked toward the immensity of the Junrayuma, the vault of the Tusk, rearing in stony silence above the multitudes. Clots of priests and other functionaries milled on the heights, leaning between the battlements. He saw a figure pour a basket of what looked like white and yellow flower petals. They fluttered down the granite slopes before whisking out and across the ranks of the Shrial knights who barricaded the landings below. As much fortress as temple enclosure, the Junrayuma possessed the monolithic cast of a structure devoted to repulsing armies, as it had so many times in the past. Its only concession to faith was the great vaulted recess of its forward gate. Flanked by two Kyranian pillars, its dimensions were such that it could only dwarf any man standing beneath. Akamian hoped Mathanet would prove the exception. Over the past days, especially after the unnerving encounter with the Knight Commander, the new Shrya had burrowed a deep hole in his thoughts, a hole Akamian needed to fill with the force of the man's presence. Is he worth your devotion, Inrau? Is Mathanet worth your life? The summoning horns, whose bottomless timbre so resembled the ancient war horns of the Srank, sounded from behind him, hundreds of them reverberating across the great hollows of sky above. Everywhere around Akamian, men began crying out in rapture, producing a roar that gradually filled, then eclipsed the oceanic moan of the summoning horns. The horns trailed away and the roar grew, until it seemed even the walls of the Junrayuma would crack and topple. A parade of bald children, dressed in scarlet, spilled from the vault's gate, leaping barefoot down the monumental stairs and terraces, waving palm fronds in the air. The roar subsided enough to distinguish individual shouts above the wash of murmuring men. Fragments of hymns were picked up, only to falter and fade. The masses had become an impatient ground, slowly quieted in anticipation of the footfalls about to tread upon them. All of us for you, Mathanet. How that must feel. Despite what Inrau had said, Akamian knew the young man did, in his manner, worship this new Shrya, a realization that had wounded his vanity. Akamian had always cherished his student's adoration, and none more so than Inrau's. Now the old master had been supplanted. How could he rival a man who could command events such as this? But somehow, he'd managed. Somehow he'd secured the mandate eyes and ears in the heart of the Thousand Temples. Was it his cunning that had convinced Inrau, or was it his humiliation at the hands of Sarcellus? Was it pity? Had he once again prevailed by failing? An image of Geshruni flashed through his thoughts. The fact that he'd succeeded without Kantz balmed his sense of shame, somewhat. He would have used them if Inrau had refused. Akamian was under no illusions. If he had failed his mission, the quorum would kill Inrau. For men like Nocera, Inrau was a defector, and all defectors died. As simple as that. The Gnosis, even the few rudiments known by Inrau, was more valuable than any single life. But if he'd used the cants of compulsion, sooner or later the Luthaime, the college of monks and priests that managed the Thousand Temples' own vast network of spies, would have identified the mark of sorcery upon Inrau. Not all of the few became sorcerers. Many used the gift to war against the schools, and the College of Luthaime, Akamian had no doubt, would kill Inrau for bearing sorcery's mark. He had lost agents to them before. The most the compulsion could do was purchase time, that, and break his heart. Perhaps this was why Inrau had agreed to become a spy. Perhaps he'd glimpsed the dimensions of the trap fate and Akamian had set for him. Perhaps what he'd feared was not the prospect of what would happen to him if he refused, but the prospect of what would happen to his old teacher. Akamian would have used the cants, would have transformed Inrau into a sorcerer's puppet, and he would have gone mad. Priests draped in robes of gold-trimmed white and bearing golden replicas of the tusk filed four abreast between the Kyranian pillars. The tusks gleamed in the sun. Hoarse shouts broke from the low thunder of the crowd, a few cascading into many. Like wet palms, the crowd closed tighter about Akamian. His back arched with the forward heave of the masses. His feet stumbled with them. He rolled his head back and gasped. The air had taste. The corners of the sky began to drift. Blinking sweat from his eyes, he held his mouth out to the promise of cooler air, as though somewhere just above him there was a surface where the breath of thousands ended and the sky began. Voices were thunder. He looked down, and the Junryuma filled his eyes. Through fields of upraised arms, he watched the emerging form of Mathanet. The new Shrya was a powerful figure, as tall as any Norsarai, wearing a crisp white gown and sporting a thick black beard. He made the priests who flanked him seem womanish. Akamian had a sudden yearning to see his eyes, but from this distance they were hidden in the shadow of his brows. Mathanet came from the deep south, Inrau had told him, from Singulat and Nilnamesh, where the hold of the Thousand Temples was uncertain. He had walked on foot, alone in Rithi through the heathen lands of Kian. He had not so much come to Sumna as seized it. Among the jaded administrators of the Thousand Temples, his mysterious origins had been to his advantage. Simply to be an official of the Thousand Temples was to have the stink of corruption, a smell that no purity of conviction or greatness of spirit could ever scrub away. The Thousand Temples had called out to Mathanet, and Mathanet had come. Could the consult have discovered this lack, crafted you to fill it? Simply thinking that name, consult, stilled a commune. Innumerable nightmares had riddled it with so much hatred, so much dread, that it had become as much an anchor of his being as his own name. His thoughts were overwhelmed by the mouth-humid reverberations of the crowd. For several moments, the air shivered with their cries. He felt a blackening of his edges, a coldness in his chest and face. The noise of the crowd thinned and subsided. He heard something incoherent, but he was sure it was Mathanet's voice. More thunder, people straining to touch his distant image with their fingers. He reeled against the wet grip of the men surrounding him, felt the back of his throat hitching, the stinging vomit. Fevers. Then hands were all over him, and he was lifted by strangers onto the surface of the crowd. Palms and fingers, their touch so many and so light, there a moment and then gone. He could feel the sun burn against the black of his beard, against the wet salt on his cheeks. He glimpsed fumbling crevices of soaked cloth, of hair and skin, a ground of faces watching his shadow pass. Across the inner sky of half-closed eyes, the sun was spliced by tears, and he heard a voice, as clear and as warm as an autumn afternoon.
"By itself," the Shrya was crying, "Fainamri is an affront to the god. But the fact that the faithful, the Inrithi, tolerate this blasphemy is enough for the anger of the god to burn bright against us."
His body prostrate across hands beneath the sun, Akamian found himself moved to delirious wonder by the sound of the man's voice. Such a voice! One that fell upon passions and thoughts rather than ears, with intonations exquisitely pitched to incite, to enrage.
"These people, these Kianin, are an obscene race, followers of a false prophet. A false prophet, my children! The Tusk tells us that there is no greater abomination than the false prophet. No man is so vile, so wicked, as he who makes a mockery of the god's voice. And yet we sign treaties with the Fainim. We buy silk and turquoise that have passed through their unclean hands. We trade gold for horses and slaves bred in their venal stables. No more shall the faithful have intercourse with whorish nations. No more shall the faithful beat down their outrage in exchange for baubles from heathen lands. No, my children, we shall show them our fury. We shall loose upon them the god's own vengeance."
Akamian floundered in the midst of the mob's thunder, tossed by palms that would sooner clench into fists, by hands that would rather strike down than lift up.
"No, we will trade with the heathen no longer, From this day forward, we shall cease. Never again shall the Enrithi accommodate such obscenities. We shall curse that which is accursed. We shall war!
And the voice neared, as though the innumerable hands that bore Akamian could do nothing other than deliver him to the origin of such resounding words, words that had parted the shroud of the future with a terrible promise. Holy war.
Shaima!
Mathanet cried, as though this name lay at the root of all sorrow.
The city of the latter prophet lies cupped in the heathen's palm, in unclean, blasphemous hands. The hallowed ground of Shaima has become the very hearth of abominable evil. The Kisharam have made the Jeteram, the sacred heights, the den of unspeakable ceremonies, a kennel of foul, iniquitous rites. Amotu, the holy land of the latter prophet, Shaima, the holy city of Inri Sejanus, and the Jeteram, the holy site of the Ascension, have all become home to outrage after outrage, sin after loathsome sin. We shall reclaim these holy names. We shall cleanse these holy grounds. We shall turn our hands to the bloody work of war. We shall smite the heathen with the edge of the sharp sword. We shall pierce him with the point of the long spear. We shall scourge him with the agony of holy fire. We shall war, and we shall war until Shaima is free!
The masses erupted, and through his nightmarish transit, Akamian wondered, with the strange lucidity of near-unconsciousness, why the Phanum, when the schools were a cancer in their midst? Why murder another when one's own body needed to be healed? And why wage a holy war that could not be won? An impossibly distant surface of stone leaned across the sun, the Junryuma, stronghold of the Tusk, and men were lowering him across the shaded steps. Water spilled across his face, fell between his lips. He raised his head, saw a wall of shouts, flushed faces, and raised arms. They want Shaima. Shaima. The schools were never threatened. Every instant was taught with the exultant thunder of the assembly, but for some reason, an intimacy existed between those on the steps. Akamian glanced at the others, those who had been lifted from the crowd like him, shivering and drenched in exhaustion, but they were all transfixed by something on the steps above him. He looked up, startled by a worn boot a hand's breadth from his forehead. He looked into the limb-enclosed recesses of a man kneeling against the knee of another. The man wept, blinked away tears, then noticed him. In shock, Akamian watched the man's face open in recognition and then tighten in monolithic fury. A sorcerer. Here. Proyas. It was Prince Nerse Proyas of Conraya, another student he had loved. For 4 years, Akamian had tutored him in the non-sorcerous arts. But before any word could be spoken, hands guided the prince, still staring, to one side, and Akamian found himself looking into the serene and surprisingly youthful face of Mathanet. The multitudes roared, but an uncanny hush had settled between the two of them. The Shrya's face darkened, but his blue eyes glittered with... He spoke softly, as though to an intimate. "Your kind are not welcome here, friend. Flee." And Akamian fled. Would a crow wage war upon a lion? And throughout the pinched madness of his struggle through the hosts of Enrithi, he was transfixed by a single thought. He can see the few. Only the few can see the few. Mathanet grasped Proyas firmly by the arm. Then, loud enough to pierce the roaring adulation of the crowds, he whispered, "There are many things I need to discuss with you, my prince." His thoughts, still buzzing with the fury and shock of seeing his old tutor, Proyas wiped at the tears that creased his cheeks and numbly nodded. Mathanet bid him to follow Gotian, the illustrious Grand Master of the Shrial Knights, who ushered him away from the glittering Shrial procession and deep into the tomb-like galleries of the Junraiuma. Gotian hazarded several friendly comments, no doubt attempting to engage him in conversation, but Proyas could only think,
"A Carmian, insolent wretch, how could you commit such an outrage?"
How many years had passed since he'd last seen him? 4, 5 even? All that time spent trying to cleanse his heart of the man's influence, all that time leading to this penultimate moment, kneeling at the feet of the Holy Father, feeling his glory wash over him in a golden rush, kissing his knee in an instant of pure, absolute submission to the God, only to see Drusus Acamian shivering on the step below him, an unrepentant blasphemer huddling in the shadow of the most glorious soul to walk the earth in 1,000 years, Mathanet, the great shrier who would set Shaima free, who would lift the yoke of emperors and heathens from the faith of the latter prophet.
Acamian, I loved you once, dear teacher, but this is beyond all tolerance.
You seem troubled, my prince,
Gotian at last said, steering him through yet another corridor. Incense from a melange of fragrant woods steamed through the open spaces, gifting the points of lantern light with halos. Somewhere, a choir practiced hymns.
I apologize, Lord Gotian, he replied. It's been a most remarkable day.
That it has, my prince, the silver-haired Grand Master said, a wise smile creasing his face. And it's about to become more remarkable still.
Before Proyas could ask him what he meant, the colonnaded hallway came to an end and opened onto a vast chamber flanked by colossal pillars, or what he had thought was a chamber, for he quickly realized that he stood within a courtyard. Sunlight poured through the distant ceiling, piercing the gloom with slanted beams and stretching fingers of light between the western columns. Proyas blinked and stared across the courtyard's sunken mosaic floor.
Could it be?
He fell to his knees.
The tusk.
A great winding horn of ivory, half in sunlight and half in shadow, suspended by chains that soared upward and were lost in the contrast of bright sky and pillared gloom.
The tusk, holiest of holies, shining with oils and ribbed by inscriptions, like the tattooed limbs of a priestess of Gira.
The first verses of the gods, the first scripture, here, before his eyes.
Here.
After several breathless moments, Proyas felt Gotian's consoling hand fall upon his shoulder. Blinking tears, he looked up at the Grand Master.
Thank you,
he said, his voice hushed by the immensities that surrounded him.
Thank you for bringing me to this place.
Gotian nodded, then left him to his prayers. Triumphs and regrets alike wheeled through his thoughts. His victory over the Tidoni at the Battle of Peremti, the words of hatred he'd uttered to his older brother the week before he died. It seemed that here the hidden nets were drawn to the surface at last, so that all these events could be gathered onto the deck of this moment. Even the years he'd spent under Acamian as a boy, chafing through drill after drill, laughing at his gentle jokes, had a place in preparation for this moment, now, before the tusk.
I submit to your word, God. I commend my soul to the fierce task that you have laid before me. I shall make a temple of the field of war.
The sound of birds frolicking among the high eaves, the smell of sandalwood rinsed by sky-clean air, bands of streaming sunlight, and the tusk, poised against the shadows of mighty Kyrenian pillars, motionless, soundless.
It's heartbreaking, is it not?
A powerful voice said behind him,
to see the tusk for the first time.
Proyas turned, and though he'd long thought himself beyond adulation, he could not help staring at the man with adoring eyes. Mathanet, the new, incorruptible shrier of the 1,000 temples, the man who would bring peace to the nations of the 3 seas by offering them holy war.
A new teacher. Since the beginning, it's been with us,
Mathanet continued, staring reverently at the tusk.
Our guide, our counsel, and our judge. It is the one thing that witnesses us, even as we behold it.
Yes, Proyas said. I can feel it.
Cherish that feeling, Proyas. Grasp it tight to your breast and never forget, for in the days that follow, you will be besieged by many men who have forgotten.
Your grace?
Mathanet walked to his side. He had exchanged his elaborate gold-chased robes for a plain white frock. His every movement, every pose, it seemed to Proyas, conveyed a sense of inevitability, as though the scripture of his acts had already been written.
I speak of the holy war, Proyas, the great hammer of the latter prophet. Many men will seek to pervert it.
I have already heard rumors that the emperor...
And there will be others as well,
Mathanet said, his tone both sad and sharp.
Men from the schools.
Proyas felt chastened. Only his father, the king, ever dared interrupt him, and only when he'd uttered something foolish.
The schools, your grace?
The shrier turned his strong bearded profile to him, and Proyas was struck by the crisp blue of his eyes.
Tell me, Nurse Proyas,
Mathanet said with a voice of edict,
who was that man, that sorcerer, who dared pollute my presence?